Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're offering the second segment in our financial podcast series. Now, as most of our readers are aware, Adam and I have worked hard to identify a few independent financial advisory firms that see the world through a similar lens that we do. We did this to have a useful, well-vetted solution to the many requests we get each month from people seeking a referral to financial advisors who get it. Now that we've endorsed these advisors, we thought it would be a helpful exercise to bring them on the program from time to time to ask them to address the money-related questions our readers care about most. So today, we're going to do just that. Once again, we've asked you to submit your pressing questions about 401ks and other retirement accounts, and boy, did you deliver. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking with the team at New Harbor Financial. That's Bill Cole, Mike Preston, and John Lodra. Now, before we get started, I'll make it clear that Peak Prosperity has a commercial relationship with New Harbor Financial, one in which fees are shared on referred accounts. It's important to note that this arrangement does not result in any increased fees charged to the end consumer. You're charged the same as if you'd walked in through the front door. All the details on this arrangement are provided clearly in writing during the referral process. Okay, now with that out of the way, how about each of you briefly introduce yourselves by telling us how long you've been in the financial profession and your role at New Harbor?
Hi, thanks, Chris. I'm Bill Cole. I'll go first because I'm by far the eldest here. I started in 1980 with Payne Webber, actually, and stayed there until that's the three of us, left Wall Street, so to speak, in order to establish New Harbor Financial Group. We did that in January of 2005, and all's been very good since then. It's nice to talk to you again, Chris.
Thanks.
Hi, Chris. This is Mike Preston. I'm one of the partners here at New Harbor Financial, and I've been in this business since 1999. Thanks for having us on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure. John?
Hi, Chris, and hello, Peak Prosperity listeners. John Lodra here. I came to the financial services industry by way of the energy industry, first as a management consultant and then as an executive in an investment bank in commodity energy trading. I've been doing the retail financial services industry since about 2002.
Great. Hey, thank you all. So, New Harbor, you all joined up together. It's a great firm. It happens to be one which is, managing money of relatives of mine as well. And what is it that you think makes you stand out, makes you different from potentially other advisory firms out there?
Well, answer that. It's Bill first, anyway. We started New Harbor because we recognized that clients and we felt that the proper way in which to address client concerns and manage money and retirement goals, et cetera, required that we be independent. We've certainly not regretted that and been happy to avoid all the embarrassments and conflicts of industry, or conflicts of interest that our former employers got into later. At New Harbor, we've been able to be completely on the same side of the table as the client and talk to them about things that often don't involve investments per se. Certainly not financial investments. So we help with debt management, and we help with outside assets and a lot of the concerns that many Peak Prosperity listeners and others have. So we established it that way. We work with clients on a holistic sort of basis to see where they stand and where they want to be and how we can hopefully help them get there with the least amount of risk.
Oh, that, excellent. You know, it was a number of years ago that you and I, Bill, got together because you'd watched the Crash Course. And starting at the outside here, you know, the world of investing, and look at all the predicaments we have out there. We've got them in the economy, energy, the environment, further most heavily interventionist Fed in history, coupled to the most asleep-at-the-switch regulatory environment. What sorts of investing principles govern your daily actions and overall portfolio strategy here?
Well, I'd have to say that we put a real premium on flexibility. We do not accept that so-called traditional paths to investing and success are going to work. We agree with you, Chris, that the next 20 years, and we're probably already in them, are going to be unlike those of the past, and we want to be able to be flexible. And now we don't know just what that means or when it's going to happen, and therefore we have to diversify and as I say, stay pretty nimble. We do not want to
be tied into any vehicles or any plans that are going to hold us in place when we would perhaps be seeing decisions and patterns unfold. I mean, decisions by, by banks and governments and investment trends change. We don't want to be trapped into anything. So we believe that those diversifications that are critical involve cash. They involve physical metals, as we've talked about with you and clients many times, other hard assets, skills, as I said, debt management, locating to the proper place, and basically not traditional investments like mutual funds and limited choice 401ks, etc.
Great. Speaking of not wanting to be trapped, a lot of our listeners right now do feel trapped and trapped by their retirement accounts. The number one question we get at Peak Prosperity, either at the website or when I'm traveling, is should I cash out my 401k or derivatives of that question? And I know there's no easy answer for that. There are a lot of variables to consider, including age, income, tax bracket, other assets, many more. So to begin to unpack this really complex and vitally important topic of retirement and retirement accounts, let's walk through it carefully. So if I approached you guys at New Harbor and requested help with retirement planning, what would the process be like? Can you walk me through it?
Sure, Chris. This is John. The first steps we would take are probably not unlike many other well-qualified financial service firms. We would first want to meet with a client in person or over the phone. A lot of our clients are very geographically distant, so we certainly can do our work over the phone. But we'd want to take a pretty in-depth inventory of a client's particular situation. The routine things like an inventory of assets and liabilities and, some of the softer things like, what their concerns are, what their goals are. And we'd also like to, in that discussion, talk with them about areas of where they may have, invested in their own resiliency, a common theme that many Peak Prosperity readers are certainly in tune with and have taken meaningful steps to make progress with. Because we very much know that what we can do for clients insofar as investment management is just one quadrant of their life that they should be taking very serious and thoughtful steps to prepare for. We would ask them about their timelines in terms of needs for money and what kind of goals they have for themselves. And we would certainly review investment allocations, and that's where it would really very much tie back into Bill's comments about our, belief that flexibility and non-traditional investment approaches are very much not only important, but we would say critical for the years ahead that we foresee. So we would look for ways to coach them as to how either working with a firm like ours or on their own self-direction, they can either avail themselves of available to them through their retirement plans at work or otherwise, or coach them through some specific mechanisms by which they can kind of get untrapped, if you will, from those plans. So, for example, there are very specific rules that one can comply with to get money out of employer plans without incurring tax penalties or taxes on the tax-deferred monies, as well as IRAs. So, for example, many clients or prospective clients are not aware that even while they're still working at a particular employer, many times they can get money out of these employer-sponsored plans that typically have very limited investment choices that don't allow for, a 3E strategy, to use the Peak Prosperity lexicon, things like an in-service rollover, where you can roll over an employer-sponsored plan without leaving that employer into a self-directed IRA, which can be invested in almost an unlimited number of ways. And then things like there are specific tax code rules like Section 72T that allows one, no matter their age, to take money out of an IRA without the normal taxes, without the normal penalties that would apply for someone that's below the age 59 and a half. And we'd be happy to explore in detail those rules with you.
So let me get specific then. So imagine, let's assume I have a retirement account and it's from a current employer and I'm interested in protecting it at a minimum, but maybe I have an open set of questions as to whether maybe I should add more because my employer has this incredible matching function. Maybe I don't add any more. Does that make sense today? Or maybe I take some out, redeploy it elsewhere, or maybe even just dump the whole thing, take the hit, and use the money in some other way. That's the typical range of, I guess, options people are considering here. So let's start right at the top then. I have this employer-sponsored plan, and I'm in it right now. First of all, how do I think about, let's say my first question is I want to protect it. I want to make sure that this is reasonable and well-run and it's going to be there for me. How do I begin to approach that?
Oh, hi, Chris. This is Mike. I'll respond to that. You've really raised a lot of topics there that are very important, and a lot of our clients are asking. They're very concerned about the safety of their funds inside of a 401k plan. And really, when assessing the safety of a 401k plan, there's really two sets of risks that you have to be concerned with. One would be the risk of the custodian itself. If you had let's say a 403b, which is a plan very similar to a 401k at an insurance company where most of them reside, we'd want to take a look at the safety and the financial stability ratings of the insurance company. For the most part, though, 401ks are held at very large providers, and other than reading public documents, there's not really a lot you can do to assess the underlying viability of that institution. I mean, there are some things we can take a look at. Probably prefer to handle those on a one-by-one basis. But I think really a bigger risk is the investment risk inside of the 401k. We'll probably talk about the risk of confiscation a little bit later, but it's really investment risk that I think we should focus on here, and that's the easiest thing to get your arms around. In terms of investment risk, we tend to run into a lot of clients that are locked into a 401k and don't have a lot of choices. That's the number one complaint we have, is that clients don't have a lot of fund choices inside of their 401k. They might only have four or five choices, and they won't typically include any non-traditional choices like either inverse or short funds or gold and precious metals funds. So if really their problem is limited fund choices, which is by far the biggest complaint we see, we would ask them to lobby with their employer to perhaps change providers, and in changing to a different provider, obviously we could choose and help them choose one that's a little more financially safe, but at the same time, make sure that new provider offers a lot of alternative choices, like I just mentioned, perhaps falling dollar funds or inverse funds or gold and precious metal funds. Also, some plans offer a self-directed brokerage window, which means that you can take a portion of the money in your 401k and invest it through a regular brokerage account. And, of course, when you do that, you can invest directly in anything, just about anything that you want, including gold and precious metal, exchange-traded funds and closed-end funds, and things like that. If it's a company owner, for instance, if it's a small business owned by one or two people, it's a small firm with not a lot of employees, you can shut down the plan and potentially even, you know, choose a plan with more flexible options like a simple IRA or a SEP IRA if it's a very small company.
Okay, that's excellent advice. So Mike, you said two big risks here. We have custodian risk. We've got the investment risk. On the investment risk side, maybe our hands can be a little tied if our 401k opportunities or universe is not that large at the company we work for. So we might lobby. Maybe we can get to self-directed brokerages. But let me start with the highest level of investment risk there is. What are your views on the good old days of buy and hold? That was what I was always told once upon a time, and it's tempting, right? Because then you just put money into your 401k, you close your eyes, hope for the best, wake up in 20 years and look at your statement and hope you did good. Where do you stand on buy and hold these days?
Chris, this is John. I'll chime in on behalf of our team on that. You know, really getting back to Bill's opening comments, you know, we do place high value on flexibility, and that, you know, by extension means we don't really believe that the traditional buy and hold approach is fitting for the times we're in. These markets are very volatile, and we expect them to remain that way, certainly fueled by some of the policy decisions that we've seen come from policymakers throughout the world. And buy and hold really is, if we could translate that in a layperson's firm, is blind faith in markets. And we certainly have a healthy skepticism, as we think most folks should, for the financial markets in the traditional sense, stocks, bonds, and that kind of thing. So, you know, that's why, you know, whereas most industrialized financial service firms would lead you to believe that every day you're out of the market is a lost opportunity, we think the hallmark of investment success is knowing when not to invest, or at least having times of restraint in plowing one's financial assets into financial markets. So that's why we routinely, certainly when we measure risk to be high and rewards to be on the low side, you know, we routinely will hold sometimes high levels of cash in an account, not because certainly in the current environment we think cash is kicking off a lot of meaningful interest, but it's simply a safe haven to keep some powder dry for when we expect, you know, pullbacks in various financial assets to present more attractive buying levels. You know, the old adage, buy low, sell high. Well, you can only do that if you have cash on hand to buy low. So that's one of the most simple ways of you know, shunning the buy and hold approach in favor of a more flexible approach.
All right, so let's assume we're comfortable with the custodial risk. We've got an investment strategy where we're apportioning across the 3E strategy, if that's what appeals to us. Maybe we're diversifying by holding cash as a reasonable asset. We've got maybe gold. We've got other ways of sort of diversifying into what we think this environment is. But let's start with the question around withdrawal. I mean, I know I've faced this question from people who are young and people who are very close to retirement age or in retirement about how do you go about the process of withdrawals. I know it was mentioned earlier that there are some provisions in the code, the 72T, things like that. I want to understand what the process is for assessing when and how much to begin the process of withdrawal. So first up, are there any big differences between the different types of retirement accounts out there that I need to be aware of?
Right, Bill here again. Yes, there certainly are. You know, the employer-sponsored plans like the 401k and the 403b, typically, but not always, especially in recent years, come with the provision of a match by the employer. And I will say that in general, the main reason, and for some people the only reason, to participate in an employer-sponsored plan like that is to get the match. Therefore, we often find ourselves telling people, sure, they're going to give you 100% or 50% or even 25% of the first 3 or 4 or 5 or 6% of your salary that you put into that plan. Then go ahead and do it. Collect the match, which you're entirely invested in, but don't do any more than that, because that extra part you might do beyond the match is really the only benefit is the tax deferral. And in traditional days where people would say, well, but my tax bracket's going to be lower when I retire, I can save and compound with this buy and hold strategy and take it out later and everything will be fine. But we don't believe that's likely to be the case. We certainly suggest that the matched part is enough to put into those plans. Beyond that, if they want to continue to save somewhere else, they can do it in a taxable account, which has various tax benefits too, like long-term gains treatment and dividend, you know, tax treatment. That's favorable. They also could invest in a Roth if they wanted to, rather than the tax-deferred IRA or additional, you know, monies into the 401k. Quick back though to one thing I wanted to add when we talked about withdrawal strategies from a plan in general, and Mike had mentioned that if you actually control the company, you might want to replace the plan. And one key component there of the strategy is that you, by closing the plan rather than simply replacing it, you might actually free up all that money to go into a self-directed IRA and then start a new plan if you wanted to. Many employers don't like that concept, but the ones that are in control might be able to do it. Secondly, there are some easy things we should just touch on real quick. If you're in a 401k and you're wondering how to get your money out, remember that it's the money that came from a former employer that you might have rolled into that one is available for you to move right from that current employer's plan into an IRA. There's also the situation where if you are laid off or quit or whatever, and you're 55, you know, that's where the penalty comes into play with your 401k plan. And in fact, it's only 50 years old. If you're you know, firefighter or police officer, you can access that money without that penalty. So there we want to be careful not to take the money out and put it in an IRA where it would be subject with that penalty up to 59.5. So getting the money out, I think it's important to have a strategy to get the money out and over the tax hurdle. And you know, we do have the 72T strategy with a which, you know, it's a complicated formula, but as you take money out of that, you basically can pull it out and avoid the penalty as long as you do it with a substantially equal periodic payments, and do it until you're 59 and a half, or for 5 years, whichever is later, and therefore you can get some money out anyway. The numbers, these are approximate, but if you say for every $100,000 you put into a 72T program, and by the way, there's one for annuities too, 72Q, every $100,000 of money that you put into that program will get you, if you're, say, 50 years old, about 3.5% typically. So if you've got, you know, $100,000 there, you can get a little bit of money out every year anyway without that penalty. But you're committed to stay with that plan. You don't have to do it with a whole balance. You can commit some to that strategy. Earlier, John had mentioned in-service withdrawals, which are sometimes available, depending on the plan. And then the situation also, you know, where you simply decide to pay the penalty and get the taxes out, you can run illustrations, and you'll typically find that you'd better really be comparing it to a much higher tax bracket down the road in order to pay, you know, normal taxes plus the 10% penalty at this point. Some people are committed to doing that, but many are not. You also want to look at your tax bracket. They're probably going to rise for everybody. We don't know that, but probably they are. People should be aware for many reasons of where their marginal bracket is and take money out to the upper end of the bracket they're willing to pay taxes.
What were these in-service withdrawals? Can you spell those out for me?
This is John, Chris. I'm happy. You know, the very first place listeners should start is by obtaining or asking for what's called a summary plan description for the qualified retirement plan, be it a 401k or 403b. That's a layperson's description of the plan that they're in. And every plan is required by law to provide that summary plan description, or SPD for short, to anybody that requests it. And, you know, if you have a, if the listeners have a online portal that they can log into their 401k plan, say if it's at a firm like Fidelity or similar firm, oftentimes there's a document section in their login, and they can just simply go to that document section and they'll most likely find a copy of the SPD, or summary plan description. In that, there will be certainly a section that will speak to the scenarios by which folks can get money out of their retirement plan. The usual one is when you separate from service, either get fired or electively leave. That's certainly an event where one can roll money out of an employer-sponsored plan. But many plans, and we find that typically some of the larger, you know, blue-chip type companies have this feature more often than not, allow for what are called in-service withdrawals or distributions. And that simply allows an employee, sometimes regardless of their age, to do a rollover of funds to a self-directed IRA while still maintaining employment at the particular company, and thereby allowing themselves to get access to a self-directed investment strategy that can tap into a wide variety of assets. And it's funny, you know, many folks aren't aware of this. In fact, we've had, you know, many clients and prospective clients, you know, get to the point where they literally considered quitting their job just to get their money out, and you can bet they were very relieved to find that they didn't have to quit their job to get their money to a more flexible investment platform.
Wow, that is a serious consideration then. So some people, though, are considering the idea of taking withdrawal because they want to just get the money out of whatever vehicles they happen to be in at this point in time. I'm sure there are a lot of implications to that, your age, the tax bracket you're in right now. Bill, you had mentioned the future potential tax brackets. There are a lot of variables that have to factor into that. So I assume you would help walk somebody through that. A question we get a lot, though, I know nobody can predict the future, though, is where are tax rates going to be in the future? You gave a little tip of the hand, Bill, when you said potentially a lot higher. Given the state of the world and where governments are going, that seems to be useful. How do we get our arms around this idea that the rules will get changed, be those tax rules, be those withdrawal rules, be those age limitations, whatever those rules happen to be? Is that something that you make a pass at in your planning, or is that something you just advise people we just have to wait and see?
Well, we do like to weigh different possibilities and guide people accordingly, but that guidance typically has to do with diversification and
flexibility, as I say, because we don't know what's going to happen. It's easy to imagine some scenarios where tax rates would rise for people of substantial income, or perhaps even someday people of substantial wealth, and not so much for people who are having a hard time. Many people, as long as they're working, they're not concerned so much about pulling their 401k or IRA money out at a high cost. But if they're unemployed, then they would need to get to that money. So let's remember that if that happens, or they have substantial medical expenses or college expenses and some of those things that do qualify for tax exceptions, you know, from on withdrawals, if they need it later, there's a good chance they won't be in a high income tax bracket because of their loss of employment, typically. So, you know, we may want to weigh some scenarios like that, or somebody says, you know, I'm going to move to my farm in the countryside, I'm not going to have much income, and therefore in 3 years my tax bracket's going to drop way down. Well, that might be a good time to say, well, instead of paying a penalty now, let's go ahead and look at taking income out at a very low bracket down the road, perhaps a low bracket even if they've risen in general. So we can kick around scenarios, but of course we can't predict, you know, what's going to happen, except that it's hard to imagine that taxes are not going to rise for at least some of the population, given the deficit situation.
Sure. And what about in the case of somebody who literally has all of their retirement assets parked in a 401k, and they don't have any access to precious metals, don't feel they can get access to that within the construct of their 401k? This is a question that does come up. People say, I would like to have precious metals exposure, but I don't see how to do it, and all my money's tied up over there. What would your advice be there?
Well, it comes up a lot, for sure. And like Mike had mentioned earlier, you can lobby for different choices, so maybe they've got something to do in there inside the plan. But if they end up wanting to get some metals, not wanting to pay the penalty, then the 72T, you know, withdrawal situation that we talked about can make some sense. Again, if they've got all their money, as you say, tied up, I mean, let's just say it's, you know, $500,000 or something in a 401k, and they need money out, you know, and they're 55 years old, they're going to be able to take out, you know, $20,000 a year that would be taxable but not subject to a penalty, and that money might, you know, be well invested in precious metals, sure. So they can do that, or they can go somewhat beyond that and pay the penalty if they decide. You don't have to do it with the whole thing. But, you know, it's hard to imagine rates are going to rise very quickly, like in 3 or 4 years, so that everybody's going to be paying, you know, 50% bracket on whatever they take out. Here's John.
Chris, this is John. You know, one thing you're hitting the nail on the head with here is many folks aren't aware that really, specifically with respect to IRAs, and let's assume you can get some money out of your employer sponsor plan into an IRA account, there are a lot of non-traditional assets that one can hold in an IRA. In fact, the law allows you to hold essentially anything in an IRA except for collectibles like artwork and things like that, and life insurance, okay? Anything else is legally possible. So, for example, one can own farmland, physical farmland, in an IRA. One could own a strip mall if they were so, desiring. Not mm-hmm. that we're recommending that, but the point is you can hold a lot of different non-traditional, non-financial, I'll even say, assets in an IRA. So folks that are inclined to want to incur a big tax hit to get money out to put into non-financial assets, they should know they don't necessarily need to do that because they can hold these kinds of things in an IRA. Now, the trick is, when you're talking about non-traditional assets like this, and physical gold bullion would qualify in our minds, as well as, you know, physical land or business entities for that matter, the trick is finding a non-traditional custodian that will serve as the reporting custodian for this non-financial, non-traditional asset. And many of the reader questions touched upon this, and in fact, we saw that at least one response rightly pointed out that if you do a Google or web search for non-traditional custodians, there are dozens of firms out there that do this. So there's no shortage of firms that do this. There certainly are some things we would advise folks to look for and be careful of in doing this, but just know that these options are available. Some of the things you want to be mindful of things like, say we're going to invest in physical farmland in an IRA. Well, if you sell crops from that farm, technically, the proceeds needs to be retained inside the IRA. You can't take the money and go buy a car with it because it's essentially would be deemed a distribution from the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually some pretty complicated rules. You know, so if you're going to own a farm, you're most certainly likely to form some kind of business entity. There are a couple terms that I'd like to throw out, and you know, our time constraints here really don't allow us to dive deeply into these, but there's what are called prohibited parties and prohibited transactions. And quite simply, prohibited parties are, you know, the IRA owner, him or herself, their parents, children, you know, direct lineage, basically. So, for example, you can't buy a house in an IRA and live in it, okay, because you're deemed to be receiving a current benefit from that house and would invalidate the, you know, kind of the tax-deferred nature of that holding.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, you can't buy a house and have your, you know, mother live in it, because, again, it would be a prohibited party. There are also prohibited transactions, and this is where it gets, you know, step level of higher complexity, and we certainly can't touch upon that in detail. But things like if there's a business entity, no more than 50% of the ownership interest can be comprised of, collectively, of prohibited parties. Now, there's a lot of good resources out there, and in fact, you know, we came across a small non-traditional custodian that has a wealth of educational resources on their website. That particular company is called Advanta IRA, and the website is AdvantaTrust.com. You know, it's a small company, so we, you know, urge clients to do their own due diligence, but they have a lot of good educational resources on this topic on their website.
So in every case, then, do all of these non-traditional IRAs, whether we're going to be investing in farmland or in some sort of real estate or potentially in something else, those all have to be held by a custodian?
Hi, Chris. This is Mike. I'll respond to that. Yes, you need to have a custodian involved when you are investing IRA money in non-traditional assets. Now, the non-traditional custodian, if we could use that term, all they really are is a service provider. The two biggest things that a non-traditional custodian does is they receive money from the IRA owner, and then they send a check off to the ultimate investment. So basically, they make the investment for you. That's one of their biggest functions. The second biggest function that they perform is that of record keeper, and so they will take into account annual valuations and appraisals and things like that of assets. In the case of precious metals, it's pretty easy because they're marked to market basically by the minute, and those are easy to value. In the case of real estate, an appraisal might be ordered for annual valuation. And the valuations are important because these custodians have to report to the IRS on Form 5498 the valuation of the non-traditional IRA on an annual basis. They also will take in and process distributions for the IRA owners and send Form 1099s to the IRS as well. So really they're a service provider, a liaison, or a middle person, if you will, that helps you get the non-traditional investment done. But once the non-traditional investment is done, that money is off at the ultimate destination. For instance, if you're buying a piece of farmland, the party that sold the farmland will receive money from the non-traditional custodian, and really the only way the non-traditional custodian will be involved from that point is they'll do an annual valuation and the appropriate reporting to the IRS.
So I'm interested. Maybe I want to hold precious metals. Maybe I want to hold farmland. Maybe it's life insurance is measured. How would I choose a custodian? What are the things I want to consider here?
Okay, again, this is Mike. Let me point out that life insurance is prohibited in IRAs, life insurance and collectibles, but talking about the other assets such as precious metals and other tangibles.
Oh, and clear this up for me real quick, because I know that precious metals are taxed at what's called a collectibles rate. So we've used the word collectibles as not okay in a self-directed IRA. Can you clarify that for me?
Yeah, in general, when you hold collectibles or precious metals in a regular taxable way or in a taxable account, a special collectibles tax rate of 28% doesn't apply, which is a maximum tax rate. Of course, if your income is in the lower levels, then you might actually pay less than 28%. However, when you hold precious metals and non-traditional assets like that in an IRA and then ultimately take possession of them, that is to distribute them out of the IRA, you'll pay tax at your present marginal tax bracket. So really, people are confused thinking they always pay 28%. on distributions of, let's say, gold from their IRA. But that's not true. If they either sell the gold inside the IRA and take the cash out or take a distribution in kind of the gold, the value of that distribution, once it's pulled out of the IRA, will be taxed at that IRA owner's marginal tax bracket. It'll be taxed as ordinary income on their Form 1040.
Okay, great. So in this non-traditional IRA, we can hold everything except collectibles, but precious metals are okay, and life insurance. Can't hold that either. So how do I choose a custodian here?
Choosing a custodian, it's important to understand, as I mentioned earlier, a custodian is simply just a service provider. So there's really a couple things that you have to think about, but really one of the most important, besides safety, and I'll get into that in just a moment, one of the most important is really how's their service, because that's really what their job is. Are they responsive? Are they reachable? There's some big firms out there that are very hard to get in touch with. There's some big firms that are great. There's some small firms that are very, very easy to get in touch with and help you answer the questions that you have. So first of all, you have to try to assess what is your level of service, and really that only comes about by making a few calls. And you could just, again, as John mentioned earlier, do a Google search. There is a number of large firms, or three to five firms that will come up right away if you do a Google search. Really, the other thing to be concerned about besides their level of service is who is their custodian. So some of the smaller firms are service providers and they have a separate custodian. Some of the larger firms have their own custodian. You really want to drill down into who's the custodian that is reporting and where are uninvested funds held. So when you send, let's say, $100,000 off to one of these non-traditional custodians, where is that money held? For instance, if you send $100,000 off and then subsequently buy $50,000 worth of gold, where is the $50,000 in cash held? That's pretty important. You want to make sure that's held at a FDIC-insured bank and that those funds are secure.
And then, of course, this is John. I'll add to that. Of course, you know, in this example Mike just laid out where you're buying physical bullion, the key piece on that $50,000 is where is that bullion being held physically. You want to, and this is different than the custodian. Typically, the custodian doesn't do the holding. That's typically a depository or a vaulting option that is separate from the service agent slash custodian. And you know, obviously, one wants to do their due diligence in terms of the segregation practices of the particular vaulting option that's being utilized. You want to be able to verify the existence, obviously, the whole reason for holding the physical gold of your specific allocation. So the two together are very, very important points of due diligence that one wants to go through.
All right, and there is some complexity here in this non-traditional IRA you mentioned before. There are these prohibited parties and transactions, direct lineage, can't derive the present benefit. And you mentioned a website before, John, that is AdvantaIRAtrust.com.
No, I'll clarify. It's AdvantaTrust.com. And again, we point to this because we have found it to be a great website for information. You know, certainly due diligence is needed in all these with all these custodians, but they have a very good educational page there for interested readers.
Oh, well, I'm interested. I'm going to go look at that. So that's AdvantaTrust.com. Thank you. So what I'm getting from this whole 401k IRA, non-traditional IRA discussion is that obviously there are a lot of moving pieces. There's quite a bit of complexity built up here. And that one of your specialties is helping people sort of sift and winnow through all of these options because they're fairly specific and unique, it seems, even though there are some broad brushstrokes we can paint. I guess almost every circumstance has its own wrinkles.
Well, there's truth to that, yes. It is complex. And let me just interject that because complexity is generally not something we favor, I would say that if somebody wants physical gold, and they often ask how to do that in their IRA, I would suggest that they first ask whether they have all they want or can afford, basically, outside of an IRA. I mean, to physically have possession, it seems to me to meet the basic reasons that we would have such a thing, much better than having it anywhere in an IRA.
Oh, absolutely. I fully concur with that. All right, so let's move on. We've got a little bit of time left, and I know that IRAs and 401ks and whatnot are just one component of the retirement equation here. What about Social Security benefits? We get a lot of questions around those. People who are wondering if they're young, are they going to be there when I get there? For people who are close or are actually already receiving, there are still considerations and things to know. What's the basic primer there? What do we need to know about Social Security?
Right, Bill here again. Well, I would say that for the younger people, first of all, they don't have a lot of choice. It's going to be going into the system, you know, through their payroll. And probably if they're self-employed, they should be making those contributions anyway in order to build up their eligibility and then find out down the road what they really get. They certainly are much more likely than people, say, in their 50s in order to see, you know, a real erosion of the likely benefits they'll get. Even that said, people in their 50s may well see, probably will see, a further pushed off full retirement age, perhaps more, you know, or different indexing of benefits, maybe more in means testing, maybe more taxation of the Social Security benefit, which is right now up to a maximum of 85% of it is taxed, is taxable, you know, at a normal rate. So we'll probably see some impact on that. But I'm not one to say that we shouldn't count on those benefits, particularly for people who are, say, 50 or above. You know, obviously, it's a huge voting lobby. As you pointed out very many times, Chris, the politicians are not likely to mess with that if they don't have to. They may erode it, but I think there will be benefits there for people. And let's just assume, then, that that what the people really need to understand is the best way to take that money. As most would know, you can start at 62, full retirement age for most people, and take a reduced amount at that point, or you can let it go longer, all the way up to age 70, where it maxes out, you know, at an amount that's about 8% higher per year than had you started at 62. Generally, that makes sense to do if one can afford to, or at least go to the 66, particularly if one is married, because the spousal benefit, you know, is going to continue for the survivor at the same level where it was set by the higher earner. But let's also talk about the interplay briefly here, because it's very complicated, of spousal benefits, where a couple goes in and decides on the best strategy. And they're not likely to get this advice just from the Social Security representative that, you know, it's claimed that there's $10 or more billion a year of benefits that are simply not collected by people because they don't choose the right strategy annually. So when the couple goes in, they really want to look at their age, at their respective, you know, benefits, which are based on their earnings history, and then decide whether it's best for both of them to start at one point, like 62 or 66, or both to defer, or whether or not, and this is more likely, that it makes sense for one of them to start, for one of them, let's say, to file, but not actually collect it, let their own benefit go longer, but by filing and suspending, as it's called, then the spouse at their own full retirement age can come in and collect half of the benefit that the person who's actually in deferral on it would have collected. So that spousal benefit can be very valuable. And then later, they go on to their own benefit if it gets to be higher than the spousal. So there's a real interplay there, and people have to understand those things. So they got to go in armed with the right questions to get the right answers. Same kind of things happen when you talk about survivor benefits. You know, where it's a complicated area and many benefits are left on the table.
And how about for annuities? Do you find people coming to you with questions around annuities? Are annuities things that really can be managed, or are they for the most part really fixed and it's just then something you have to accept as is? What are the options there?
I'm glad you asked that, because it does often come up. Many times we'll take an inventory and people will say, yeah, that's everything I have I can do anything about, but I do have some annuities over here. And they think they can't do anything with them, which is generally not true at all if they haven't already annuitized and turned it into a monthly payment. So deferred annuities, whether they're fixed annuities, which is an obligation of the insurance company, or a variable annuity, which are basically tax-deferred mutual fund accounts, either of those can be moved into more modern vehicles that have many more investment choices, including some that, you know, in precious metals or against the dollar or against the market even, and so forth. If they're beyond a penalty period, there's usually in there 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years that they're committed to stay in the original product. But once they're beyond that, they can move without that and find a better home for it, perhaps one that's managed and much more flexible. Every annuity has really two components, the amount of money that went into it, which is after-tax money.
assuming we're not talking about investing in an annuity within a retirement account. So they have their original after-tax money that goes in, and then everything that it's grown by, which is all taxable income, deferred as it would be in an IRA and not taxed till it's taken out and then taxed at normal tax rates, same as an IRA. But there are ways, as I said earlier, including a 72Q option, which allows you to avoid the same kind of 10% penalty that applies on annuity income before 59 and a half. But basically, we want to see that people have the best choice, have the beneficiaries lined up the way they should be, manage that money, and have an exit strategy, if you will, for when to pay the taxes on it. So, finding out what they have and what options they have and how they could improve the situation is important. An annuity can go from one old contract to a new contract without any taxes or penalties through what's called the 1035 exchange.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And, you know, we did not make it through all the questions that were submitted here. And there are a lot of other ones around estate planning, health care, pensions, life insurance, things like that, which I would have loved to have gotten to. And I want to make it crystal clear that you gentlemen at New Harbor know a lot about retirement planning, but that is certainly just one facet of what you do and understanding these vehicles. You do all manner of financial planning and investing at this point in time. So,
true. We are each CFP certificates, you know, certified financial planners.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, gentlemen. That was really helpful, very specific, and gave people, I hope, lots to chew on.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks. And hello to everybody. Thanks,
right. Everybody. We hope you get some value out of this podcast.
And I trust anybody listening has a better sense of why these trusted advisors have our seal of approval. They're aligned with our views on how best to navigate the murkier-than-usual financial waters that we find ourselves in these days. If you are interested in following up on this and would like to meet with one of our trusted financial advisors, we have a simple, streamlined process for you to follow. Just go to the homepage of peakprosperity.com, scroll down to our very prominent resources section, click on the endorsed financial advisors link that you'll find there, fill out a very short e-form, click submit, and Adam will contact you, usually within 24 hours, to assure that you get the right attention from one of our trusted advisors. Thank you for listening. I hope you found this helpful, and thank you again, gentlemen, for your time today.
Back to the garden, Chris. Thanks. Thank you. You're welcome.